She came to the well by herself in the middle of the day when all the other women of the town were busy doing other things. Not just today, but every day. Drawing water was a bit of a daily social activity for most of the women of the town, so she designed her days around coming here when she could be alone. When the sun was high and the temperature was at its hottest. It wasn't because she liked the sweltering desert midday heat. Excuse me. Nor was it that she didn't like the company of others. It was because they were not eager to be near her. She didn't have any friends among the women here, and that didn't seem likely to change anytime soon. A lonely life didn't mean that she was always alone like this. She wasn't. There were children, lots of children. And sometimes her man was around, but who knew how long that would last? Thank you. Heaven knows she'd been left enough times before to get used to the idea that it could happen again anytime soon. Although she did know that from history that if it did happen, she wouldn't be good at being alone for very long, and there would always be another man. Women didn't want anything to do with her, but there was never a shortage of men. It hurt too much to think very hard about how much they really cared about her and how much it was about what she could do for them. But being with someone, for whatever his reasons, seemed better than raising all these kids alone. Her name was lost to history, but the Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition got tired of calling her the woman at the well, so they began calling her Photine. Photine was a Samaritan woman, not fully Jew, not fully Gentile, and accepted by neither. The Samaritans were a people ostracized and looked down upon for their mixed blood, and Photine was a woman ostracized and looked down upon even among her own. Unwanted. A woman with a really bad reputation, and no one wanted her immorality associated with them because they were already Samaritans and they needed no more burden than that. She was an outcast among outcasts. And people knew who she was. Jesus did, and he didn't even live in Samaria. One needn't be a member of the community to know about Photine. So Jesus, the then up-and-coming young rabbi that had all the villages abuzz with word of his radical teachings, decided to take a quiet moment while his friends and disciples had gone away into the city to find some lunch, and he took a walk by himself down to that well. Photine wasn't up on the latest news because she was too often it, and she'd learned to tend her own business. So she approached the well that day with discomfort, seeing a stranger nearby, having no idea who he was. She didn't know that Jesus was becoming kind of a big deal. But Jesus knew of her. And he could have greeted her by letting her know that he knew who she was. He could have greeted her by letting her know who he was, but he didn't do either of those things. What he did was say, "I'm thirsty." That's it. The first thing Jesus did when he met this woman was to acknowledge that he was vulnerable, had a need, and give her the opportunity to be of assistance. Photine was a woman who may have had a bit of trust issues where men were concerned, because her response was something along the lines of, "Huh. Well, I guess it's too bad you didn't bring a water bottle." "I know," Jesus responded. "I was hoping that maybe you could help me by drawing for me from your container." Immediately, another moment of vulnerability from the rabbi. And maybe the beginning of a softening of the tough facade of Photine. Still suspicious because she wasn't born yesterday, she asks him, "How is it that you, a Jew, would ask me, a Samaritan, for water?" And thus begins an exchange between new friends. in which Photin gives Jesus water, and he begins sharing his gospel of universal inclusion with her. He gives her metaphors. He doesn't dumb one thing down for her in the fear that she won't be able to understand that when he speaks of the living water, he's talking about that which is eternal in us all, for us all, and flowing through us all. Jew, Samaritan, Gentile, male, female, transgender, intersex, in crowd, wallflower, flower, and pariah. Doesn't matter. He just drinks the water and has a conversation with another human being who is his equal. And that's all. Photin is startled. Jesus senses that she doesn't get treated this way ever. And he has a moment of realization that this woman doesn't yet quite know what he wants from her. No man speaks to her without wanting something, and it's usually not water. So Jesus speaks ever so tactfully to the awkward tension of the moment, to her unwanted vulnerability in his presence, by saying, "Hey, you know, I'd love to talk more with you. Why don't you go get your husband and come back? I'd love for the three of us to have a chat together." And then Photin gets voluntarily vulnerable out loud. She says, "I don't have a husband." Jesus says, "Okay, your boyfriend. Photin, I know you don't have a husband. You've had five of them and you're not married to the guy you live with." He said this neither to shame her nor impress her with some kind of clairvoyance, but I believe to say, "You know, I'm not really into labels. People are people. Love is love. I know who you are. I know about your partner. I know about your living situation. I don't care what everybody else thinks. I just see you. I see the woman who gave me water when I was thirsty. You met my need because you were here and you had a bucket. Well, I'm here, and I have a bottomless well of acceptance of you exactly the way you are right now, and I thought that maybe you might need some of that." So let me acknowledge that, like Jesus that day, I also know to whom I speak. I know that my home church is not a novice in the art of compassion. You get it. I don't take lightly the opportunity to stand in the pulpit of one of my greatest teachers, our own Reverend Matthew, because he is a beacon of hope and a bright and shining light in our movement and in our world. And to talk about compassion from this space is not only preaching to the choir, but it's the student teaching what she most needs to learn in a place where I have already learned more than I could ever have imagined. I know that, and I honor it. I'm here today just to remind us, to nudge us into remembering things that even while doing the sacred work of justice, we can sometimes forget. We can sometimes lose sight of an essential truth about those to whom we extend our hands and our hearts in service, and that truth is this: we do not have more to offer than they. We are a part of an energy exchange between equals, and the benevolence that we bestow upon a needy soul is not merely a selfless gift to an unfortunate. It's simply an act of sharing what we have to offer with someone else who also has something of value to offer the world. Let me be clear, it's not compassion if I offer my hand to you in your time of need and I keep score, demanding reciprocation of some kind. We know that. It's compassion to offer love and help with no thought of receiving. Think of that other Samaritan in the New Testament scripture, again nameless, who we only know as the Good Samaritan. That's a compassion story, and if you're not familiar with it, that's okay. It's a story of an outcast helping out a guy from a different social class when there was absolutely nothing in it for him at all. And the guy in need would probably not have done the same thing had the circumstances been reversed. That's a beautiful compassion story. But I believe that what Jesus did for Photin at the well was a step beyond compassion. It was inclusion. It's a step beyond compassion when you offer unconditional help to me with the understanding that whether or not I ever do anything for you, I am your equal, and you're just as likely to be the one with the outstretched hand receiving compassion for me in some way, now or in the future. You see, Jesus could have begun his social justice campaign to Fotin by saying, "Hi. You probably know that I'm getting to be a pretty famous rabbi. And I'm here, you're welcome, to bestow upon you mercy and drop some spiritual knowledge. You sit on that side of the well. I'm going to stand right over here. And I will teach you stuff from a respectable distance because I know your history with men." He could have. And that would have been a very different exchange than beginning with, "Hi, my name is Jesus. I'm thirsty." People who help people do that superiority thing sometimes. Not in words, but we don't need words to convey how we feel about each other. Our energy comes through. Earlier this year, I was listening to a podcast of This American Life, which is an NPR show. You're Unitarian Universalist, you know that. This particular episode included a segment about rats responding to the energy that we bring into the room. So a group of very average lab rats, was divided randomly into two groups. One group was given to researchers to put through a series of mazes, and the researchers were given the warning that those rats seemed to be extraordinarily dumb. Another group of researchers were given the other randomly selected rats to test in the same set of mazes, with the false forewarning that those were unnaturally brilliant rats. And then, in immeasurable, observable tests, those deceptively labeled smart rats got through the mazes in record time. And the rats, given the unfair label of underachievers, wandered around dazed and couldn't have found their way out of a holy paper bag, bless their hearts. Based on nothing but the biases of the humans who were doing nothing more than observing them, and as far as I understand, no one had told the rats. I found this remarkable. And it made me wonder. I wonder how much of my preconceived notions about the kind of women who end up in domestic violence shelters has come through while I'm doing the compassionate work of volunteering some childcare hours for their babies. And I wonder if the babies feel it too. I wonder if the days I've walked through the doors of the shelter only after a centering moment of remembering that we are all equal for real, not just in rhetoric, has changed something about the energy of the house for the whole day. And I wonder if that's really as far-fetched as it seems. I wonder if I'm more comfortable serving a homeless vet in the soup kitchen than I would be serving alongside him on the worship committee. And how hard would that be to recognize in myself? And how hard would it be to do the work of making the shift into full inclusion beyond compassion? Compassion's a starting point. It's not a finish line. The work of justice is an exchange of energy between equals. And that's not an easy truth to navigate, because we don't extend our hands with the expectation of an even energy exchange. What I'm talking about is a mindset and a heart set change in which we know in our souls that we are all helped along and we all benefit from each other equally in the long run, because that is how energy exchange works. Nothing is lost. Compassion's never a one-way stream of giving, even when it seems to be that way, and the beneficiaries of our caring are, right now, in whatever state we encounter them, our equals. I was a single mom with no place to go, on the waiting list for a bed at a women's shelter myself, when friends and family who believed I was still their equal, many of you in this room right now, began to rally the help to find me an apartment. And they hauled their furniture and household supplies themselves to help me set up a new kind of life for my daughter and me. And as many of you recall, this happened less than a year ago at the same time that you all loved me right into seminary. Because you, my beloved community, believed that the broke mom with a big mouth and a terrible job history is a woman called to the ministry. How ridiculous is that? It's ridiculous unless our souls know that our compassion is not a finish line, but a starting point. When our compassion is an acknowledged energy exchange between equals, the world changes. Whatever happened to Jesus' friend, Photine, was either never documented or those documents have never become public knowledge. It's impossible to know. We'll probably never know her real name or what became of her life or the lives of her partners and her children. But we know that her story still gets told. Over and over in different ways, extracting different meanings in beloved faith communities all over the world, people speak often of the woman at the well, and we are affected by her. Not just by how Jesus treated her, but by her story, because we know that we are all just as much like Photine as we are like Jesus, and we relate to them both. I, much like Photine, know what it feels like to have screwed everything up so badly that I begin going to the well or the Walmart at 3 a.m. just so I don't see anyone I know, because I'm in no mood to defend my life. And I've also gotten out of bed at 3 a.m. to go to a bar and pick up a sobbing friend who screwed it all up and is in no mood to defend hers. Because we are equal in our glory and in our misery. A step beyond compassion knows that we are not giving because we're awesome, but because we are the same. What I believe about this church is not that we need to change anything about what we do in our compassionate work in the world. This church is already doing it well. You help where you can help, and then you reevaluate and you find ways to help better. What I offer us today is the opportunity to explore the idea of a soul shift that moves us beyond compassion into a way of being that knows that the people to whom we extend our helping hands were already whole before we showed up, and that what they need from us is for us to show up as our whole selves and remind us that we are one. Compassion's a great starting point, but it's not a finish line. Let us remember that some days the most compassionate thing we can do for another human being in need of what we have to offer is to look them in the eyes and say, "I'm thirsty." May it be so. Amen. Let's sing together, number 1014. In your teal hymnal.
Thank you. Please be seated. It's been a true privilege to be up here today, particularly with Misha. Thank you. It's always a privilege to be here amongst all of you. You'll note in your bulletin several announcements, but much as I hate to do this, I want to call attention to the fact that August is quickly approaching. So on August 2nd is our Save the Rescues date. Please make sure you mark it on your calendar. We need a lot of help to sort through all of the rescued school supplies that will be donated. And there is a pizza party for those who volunteer. In a moment, we're going to be collecting our offering. Today, 80% of the offering is going to go to our denominational fees for the UUA. If today was your first day with us, we're particularly glad that you were here. If you did not have the chance to check in at the guest table, please do so on your way out. And everyone is welcome to join us in Deal Hall following the service for coffee and treats. We will now take up our offering.
Please rise in body and spirit. In a minute, we're going to sing our benediction song. We'll sing it, Go Your Way in Peace. We'll sing that through twice. Barb is going to extinguish the chalice. We extinguish the chalice, but not the light of love and truth and all those other things Matthew usually says by heart. Those we take with us until we meet again. The words of my beloved colleague Erica Hewitt. The hand that you hold, are we all holding hands yet? If you'd like to. The hand that you hold belongs to a person whose heart is sometimes tender, whose skin is sometimes thin, whose eyes sometimes fill with tears, and whose laughter is a beautiful sound. The hand that you hold belongs to a person who is seeking wholeness and knows that you are doing the same. As we leave this sanctuary, may our hearts remain open, may our voices stay strong, and may our hands remain outstretched. Amen.